At 5, a man who murdered his brother at their family home in East Dunbartonshire is appealing against the length of his sentence. Blair Logan was jailed for at least 20 years earlier this month for setting fire to Cameron as he slept on New Year's Day. The paedophile rock star Ian Watkins was allowed to offend for an extra 4 years after police missed numerous opportunities to bring him to justice. The Independent Police Complaints Commission has detailed errors and omissions made by South Wales Police. Founder of the National Association for People Abused in Childhood, Peter Saunders, says the officers have questions to answer.
Generally, our police do a fine piece of work, a job that most of us wouldn't want to do. But sometimes some of their colleagues get it spectacularly wrong. And when they get it so wrong, and when they get it sort of criminally wrong, then I think people need to be brought to account.
Truckers and motoring groups say they're not convinced about plans to trial self-driving lorries on motorways in England. A lead vehicle will control a convoy of up to 3 HGVs. The idea is to reduce fuel costs, emissions and congestion. Parts of Texas are preparing for potentially the most powerful storm to hit the US mainland in 12 years. Locals have been told to shelter ahead of Hurricane Harvey's arrival overnight. In some areas, evacuations have been ordered. Fox News reporter Rob Schmidt in Galveston says preparations are having to be made fast.
This thing out of nowhere intensified into a very serious hurricane. Yesterday morning, this storm was really not that big of a deal. It was going to be a big rainmaker, but it was going to be a Category 1 storm, maybe just a tropical storm. And now all of a sudden, we're talking about a major hurricane.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Southfield, Stephen Clark. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, according to George Orwell, he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. For our final show from the Beacon Centre here at the City Academy on Russell Town Avenue, we take a look at the statue mania gripping the United States and what it says about somewhat ham-fisted attempts to control history by today's deep state control freaks. Also, as Bristol's schools prepare to start a new academic year with about 1,000 less teachers, we look again at the privatisation of education, the infantilism of the mainstream media, and austerity as the elite's key weapon against the 99%. Plus, in the wake of the Barcelona attacks, we ask, are there fascists hiding in European police forces? We know all about, of course, the Golden Dawn in Greece. But could they be killing terror suspects? Not because they're dangerous, because they don't want to have to face a trial. And how does former German Security Minister Andreas von Bülow think modern terror operations are carried out? Plus, Martin Summers will have a chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and dry. Highs this weekend, highs of 22 degrees Celsius, sunny spells tomorrow, longer spells of sunshine on Sunday and over the bank holiday. Next week, highs of 24 degrees, sunnier at the beginning of the week, more showers though towards the end of the week. So it looks like that might be a rare good bank holiday. Also next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of September, highs of 21, sunny spells and some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it is Stephen Clark from Southfield. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there, Tony. Hi.
First of all, though, there is no Politics Show next Friday because BCFM is moving home. After 10 years in the City Academy, the rent is racking up, so we're sadly, as a charity, being forced to leave. But we'll be back, inshallah, in a fortnight on this show with everything you paid the BBC to tell you about the 9/11 attacks, but they didn't. With some of the top journalists in the world explaining what really happened, I'll hopefully be finding out who the architects were, how they carried out the attacks on the Pentagon and World Trade Centres, and why. Because one thing's for sure, Osama bin Laden in a cave in Tora Bora in Afghanistan certainly didn't do it all on his own. Anyway, Stephen, we are hoping to have Filton and Bradley Stoke MP Jack Napresti on this evening, but he's been called up in a meeting in London this afternoon. But yes, thanks for stepping in this week, Stephen, and also in a way it's a good thing because you're doing something much more local and something very important about council tax, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's lots of cuts going on at the moment, obviously, but one of the most difficult, I think, for the poorest people in Bristol is what's called involving what's called a council tax reduction scheme. Do you want me to say what it is briefly? And then, yeah, okay. So it's basically a way of helping really the very poorest people in Bristol to pay their council tax. And it's used by about 25,000 households in Bristol that have got children, quite a few that haven't as well. It's used by lots of people with disabilities. It's really the people who are struggling the most and simply wouldn't be able to pay the council tax. And the proposal, and there's a consultation currently going on, the proposal is to effectively make a number of people who up to now have paid zero council tax pay probably 25% or maybe even more of the amount that they would normally have paid. This is, for all kinds of reasons, this is crazy. It's immoral, it's stupid, and it's possibly illegal as well, which I'll come on to explain why I think it might be illegal. I think it's immoral because Bristol is a rich place, but there's some very poor people in Bristol. I mean, we've heard about this idea of there's a 10 years difference in the life expectancy, for example, between perhaps more than 10 years between places that are only 2 or 3 miles apart. This scheme helped those very, very poor people to survive. It's stupid because the net impact of it, in my view, will probably be zero. Because what will happen is the council, depending which of the three options...
You mean financially?
Yes.
And obviously, it's not going to be zero to those people having to pay it.
Correct. I meant to the council's finances. Because what will happen is that a number of people, for example, could be made homeless because of this. And that means they will have to access much more expensive stuff that the council is providing. So it's not a good idea from that point of view. Of course, this is a very regressive tax. What I mean by that is it impacts much more on the poorest people in society. And actually, the richer people won't even notice that this has happened because it won't impact on them at all. But the third thing, and this is something that the Greens and I think the Lib Dems actually discovered independently, if you like, is that we think it's illegal because we think the consultation that's happening at the moment and is going on till September the 24th, I think. We think we found a Supreme Court case that said that if you lay out a range of options in a consultation, one of those options has to be we don't like any of those options. We don't want that to happen. So in this case, for example, instead of reducing the amount that's given to the council tax reduction scheme, you might want to close the libraries or do something else. And that option wasn't on the consultation. So we think that legally that makes the consultation illegal. Now, we've written to the legal team at the City Council. We've written to Marvin.
Well, hang on. Because writing to the legal team at the City Council, that's a bit like a poacher writing to the gamekeeper and saying, can I come and shoot some pheasant?
Well, not really, because if we're right and it is illegal, then a member of the public could judicially review. There's a process called judicial review. Could judicially review the council, and it could... any decision that they make that's based on illegal consultation could be overturned. So we've written to them now and said, look, hang on, before we get to this decision, which is probably going to be in December, November and December, you need to rerun the consultation with legal options.
Hang on, I think they're from memory reading the article in the Post about this. It was October cabinet they're supposed to be deciding.
I think it's November cabinet, actually. And I think it then has to go before the full council in December. So they've still got time to rerun the consultation if they wanted to. But as of now, and this is, I think, about a week or 10 days after we raised this issue, we've heard nothing from the council, nothing from the legal team, and indeed nothing from Marvin.
Well, this is an interesting one, isn't it, Martin? Because you're a Labour Party member. In the Bristol Post today, Marvin Rees is saying that the city is at breaking point and is calling for people to protest, presumably against him.
Well, it's a bit of a strange situation, isn't it? I'm not really in favour of making poorer people pay council tax. I mean, the thing that obviously occurs to me, just from a practical point of view, is I did some research on council tax for Bristol Debt Advice Centre some years ago. It's a monstrous tax to collect because you're trying to get small amounts of money off people who haven't got any. And so, in actual fact, if you're going to chase these people for the small amounts of money that they're going to be billed, you might find that you're actually not actually making any money.
But
who are paying it. It's not
over
small,
£1,000.
But from the point of view of the council, it's not
worth it. It's over £1,000 a year, often, for people who've got actually no money at all.
Well, that's the point I'm making, is that the council may find that there's actually more cost involved in trying to collect these small amounts of money than they're actually going to get when they actually pin the people down. So therefore, you know, it doesn't really make much sense, even from saving money point of view.
25,000 people apparently claiming this exemption from council tax won't be able to. This sounds to me like it's a recipe for mass evictions, Stephen.
Well, I sincerely hope not. Of course, one of the problems is that when you look at where these places are, they're in, you know, all the usual suspects, Hartcliffe, Withywood, Lawrence Hill around here, Avonmouth, Lawrence Weston. They're all those places that have been hit badly in the cuts to date, and all those places that are going to be struggling, you know, to find this extra income.
I was down in Hartcliffe, actually, beginning of the week, in Greggs in Hartcliffe, and saw a lady come in, grab about 10 rolls in Greggs and just stuff them under her coat and run out. I also went over to Morrison's just after that, and there was a big altercation going on with, it looked like some children were trying to take food out of there. I mean, this seems to be where we're at in Britain nowadays. In the poorer areas, people are absolutely desperate to find something to eat.
Well, every evening and morning, I walk over the bridge onto Spike Island from Southville, and there's people camping. I don't know if you've seen them. There's people camping along the new cut, you know, 2 or 3 feet above the level of the water. And there's actually a chap down there in a disability scooter. So, I mean, you know, people are so desperate, and this is only going to get worse.
This is the fifth richest country in the world, Martin.
It is, and of course the real fundamental problem with this is the austerity policy that's been pursued since the coalition came to power in 2010. And we need to change that. And of course the demonstration on September the 9th, which Marvin is supporting, and the Green Party and others, is supposed to try and send a message to the end of the M4 to change the policy.
But why is Marvin joining it? Because he's actually part of the cuts, isn't he? Well, he's implementing them in Bristol in a way that George Ferguson never did.
Well, that's not quite true.
But it is true, because George, for example, made sure that this council tax scheme stayed in place. You know, the idea of taking £1,000 off a family that's got no money at all, George managed to stop that, but Marvin can't, apparently.
Well, if you're asking me about that, then I think Marvin will have to justify that. I don't think it is justifiable for the reasons I've just said, and it may be something that can be changed. But the fundamental problem is that there's no money. I mean, what you could say is that the libraries... what you could do is say the libraries in Tory wards should be cut because they believe in austerity. But, of course, they would say that that's not fair. I would say, well, why is it not fair?
I mean, to be fair to Marvin, I'm sure he's not happy implementing these cuts, and they are Tory cuts from central government. But our view...
But George managed not to, didn't he?
He did. George was very very supportive of the council tax reduction scheme, and actually he could have abolished it himself. He was under quite a lot of pressure to do so. I mean, you know, there's loads of problems with George, but that one particular thing I think he did was excellent. And we criticise Marvin really for not pushing back enough on austerity, you know, for not leading a march down the M4. You know, this
is a long march.
Well, it is a long march, but you know, I mean, what Marvin has done really, and what he's still doing now, is writing letters, frankly. And it's just not good enough, really.
Well, okay, so let's give you the top job. If you were mayor, what would you do?
Well, I'd be leading a march down the M4. I mean,
I wouldn't join, I'm afraid. I mean, a march is one thing. I mean, surely some sort of, you know, creative accounting, effectively, that's what George Ferguson was doing.
I can't comment on George's creative accounting. I mean, we've got quite large reserves, you know, around about 20 million. Reserves, effectively. I mean, there's different types of reserves. There's some you can use and some you can't. It looks like austerity as a policy is a kind of busted flush. You know, it looks like all the movement is away from austerity. And it's the Greens' view that if we could just hold out for this year, hold back the majority of these cuts, especially the most damaging ones like the council tax reduction scheme, who knows, there might be an election next year, you know, we might have a Labour Party. Who
it
knows?
Might fly.
Well,
the Tories are not going to have a general election at the moment,
okay.
Are they?
All right, suppose they don't. They're not in a strong position. They're, you know, George Osborne has left. I don't think they're pursuing austerity with the rigour that they were. And I think that we should try and resist these cuts as long as we can.
But one thing they're definitely carrying on doing is they're trying to make sure that by, I think it's 2022, is it, or 2024, there looks to be virtually no money coming from central government, from central taxes,
well, it's
to local government at all.
It's 2020, actually. In 2010, I looked this up before I came on because I was interested in the dates. In 2010, the council got 80% of its money from central government. In 2020, they're going to get zero.
It's almost like they're telling them, well, you just have to make money from your own city. A bit like they've been saying to quite a lot of the public services, almost like schools as well, you've got to make money yourself. Yet people are still paying their taxes. Ordinary folk are still paying their taxes to central government. It's just none of it, it seems, is being distributed anymore. It's just being spent on, maybe it's aircraft carriers or something else.
Aircraft carriers without planes.
Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously, fundamentally underlying all of this is the idiocy of austerity. And you say that they're backing off, and they're backing off on it, but they've never really implemented it because it wasn't implementable.
But they are with local government, aren't they? They're saying local government is going to get no more money.
Well, in other words, what they're doing is they're loading the pressure onto local government, which they don't control to the same extent, so that then the opposition parties in the major cities like Bristol then get blamed for the cuts, which are actually the central government's cuts. Now, you could, I mean, in Northern Ireland, the Sinn Féin were preparing not to go into a coalition with the DUP because they weren't prepared to make cuts. Unfortunately, they've been bribed in Northern Ireland with a massive bung. So the funding of local government in Northern Ireland is different. They've still got the rates because they never brought in council tax. They never brought in poll tax because it was explosive. They didn't dare to do it.
At the other end of the spectrum, what we've got is we've got some people being paid an absolute fortune. And we hit the national headlines, didn't we? Well, this region, this area did anyway, because of the Bath Vice-Chancellor at Bath University, the most highly paid Vice-Chancellor at any university in the country, being paid nearly £500,000 a year. And I thought, now, who is this person? Both the two local MPs, Kerry McCarthy and Darren Jones, have quit Bath University advisory panel of some sort. But I'm just trying to find her name, this woman, she's Professor Dame Glynis Brakewell of Bath University. I'm not sure in what way she breaks well, but she still seems to be going with this amazing salary. Yeah. And I went online to try and sort of see if I could find anything useful that she had said ever, and there was just a whole series of really boring, patronising interviews. I mean, I can imagine if I was thinking about going to a university or sending my children to her university, I'd think again after having seen her personality-free pitch for Bath being a fantastic place. But this is totally the opposite end of the spectrum, Steve.
Yeah, it's, you know, £450,000 odd pound. I mean, you know, she wouldn't do it for any less, of course. You know, the problem with both the education and health is they don't really mix with the market economy. And obviously what the Tories are trying to do is mix and meld the two. It just doesn't work. Education is education, health is health. They need to be state funded. And if you look at the best countries in the world for both education and health, they're not run by the market.
Also, the online retailer Amazon said last week it would open a distribution centre in Bristol, southwest England in 2018, continued a rapid expansion that saw its investments in the UK triple last year to over £400 million. One of the things they don't say in this Reuters article is that Amazon are one of the biggest tax evaders on the planet, Martin, but these are the people it seems are thriving in this modern world.
Well, this is a conscious plan to create a low-tax, small-state economy.
And they're also union busters, too.
Well, absolutely, which is why we can't get wages up, which we absolutely need to do in order to try and get the economy moving. But because of the bargaining power of workers has been reduced to a situation so much that even when the economy's expanding, wages stagnate. That never used to happen.
It's not rocket science. What you should do with Amazon and Starbucks and so on is the country where they raise the revenue is the country where they should pay the tax. You know, it's quite simple. They don't pay it in Luxembourg because they're not selling books and records in Luxembourg. You know, Starbucks aren't selling coffees in Luxembourg. They need to pay tax on the places where they're selling the CDs and the books and where they're selling the coffees.
So where's all this tax being kept so that it's all evaded then?
Well, what happens, Tony, is that they use transfer pricing. So they pretend they're selling the stuff in Luxembourg, when in fact they're not. And obviously what you do is HMRC just says, no, we don't believe that, and they give them a tax bill. And it's up to them to decide, to prove otherwise.
Well, except Starbucks apparently didn't make any profits for the first 10 years they were in the UK. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and that is what happens. But, again, it's clearly not working.
No.
Just on the subject of tax avoidance, or you could call it evasion maybe, but maybe we better call it avoidance just to be on the safe side. I got asked a question this week by Manfred Petrich. He's one of my favourite commentators. He's a German guy, now living in the Black Sea in Abkhazia, runs a German language blog called All Smoke and Mirrors. That's Alles Schau und Rausch in German. And he had this to say.
There is a very interesting question I always ask people. For instance, which territory is only a few hundred miles away from Brussels but does not belong to the EU?
Well, there you go with the questions. What about that? Can you answer that?
Stephen, sorry. Liechtenstein?
Martin?
A few hundred miles away from Brussels but not in the EU. Norway.
No, it's not a few hundred miles, anyway.
It's the Channel Islands. It's Crown Colony and does not belong to EU, and therefore that is the... If I want to have a tax haven, I go into the Guernsey or Jersey, or I go to one of these other offshore things, because that's the door they left open for themselves. And for all the normal guys like you and me, they closed all the doors.
Yes. So that's All Smoke and Mirrors. That's Manfred Petrich there. I mean, it does seem as if there is a sort of two worlds here. There's one world of people struggling to survive, having to steal food or go to food banks in order to feed their family, worried about evictions, and another world where the rich just simply hide all their money in Channel Islands.
That's absolutely right. And the strangest thing is, if you look at research around the world and you say, where are people the happiest, it's where you don't get those huge inequalities. The less inequalities you got, the more justice, the more equity you get, the happier everybody is, including the rich people, because they don't have to be in gated communities.
Do you think we're going to get a more equal society once Theresa May has been replaced?
Well, if it's Boris Johnson or Michael Gove or Andrea Leadsom or... No, I don't really. I think we need to replace the government, clearly.
Well, there is another person who's been put forward as a potential leader, a bit more local than that, and here is an interview. I thought I'd just put this in. Yeah. As part of our last show, from the Beacon Centre, for the sake of amusement. And this is actually from Jacob Rees-Mogg being interviewed... Oh, gosh, what must be 18 years ago now? It's a young lad he was, whippersnapper, and by someone I think you'll recognise straight away.
Wicked. I is here with Lord Rees-Mogg, and we is talking about class. Lord Mogg is going to tell us how we all can be upper class, can't we?
It was very kind of you to promote me to the nobility, but of course I'm not. My father is Lord Rees-Mogg, and I'm just a commoner like everybody else.
So what is class?
What is class? Class is how other people perceive individuals to be.
Which class is Packies in? Packies.
By which?
Which class? Is they in middle class, upper class?
You're saying Pakistanis living in England. They're not in a class by nature of where they've come from.
What do you think makes a girl upper class?
Well, exactly the same thing that makes a man upper class.
But is it things like she spits into her hanky?
I don't think spitting into one's handkerchief is widely regarded as a symbol of membership of the upper class.
What if someone is so rich they have a swimming pool? Would they be the upper class?
No, I think this is a bizarre definition of class.
What if they had a swimming pool made of gold but filled with champagne and not the cheap stuff? Then would they be in the upper class?
What if, like Cleopatra, they bathed in ass's milk?
In what?
Ass's milk.
Ass milk? Butty milk?
No. Donkeys.
All right. So what if I knobbed the daughter of a lord?
Yes. What if you did?
If she got a bun in the oven, what class would the little nipper be?
It would so much depend on the circumstances, depend on the girl in question, and so on and so forth.
So what if you got busy with my sister? You'd advise it, because she ain't the cleanest girl out there.
I haven't had the pleasure of meeting her.
Well, it can be arranged. She'll be keen.
I'm speculating on my having a relationship with somebody I've never met, and that leading to a child being born, and then as to what class it might be, is so far-fetched. As to be ridiculous. I have no idea.
What, you think you was too good for my sister?
I certainly not.
You is.
No,
you is, though. She's rank. She's nothing. No, believe me. Even my mum cussed her, tell her she's a slut. Would I be upper class if I got a top hat and wore it?
Well, would you like to try? I have a top hat. I can lend it to you for the next few minutes of this interview, if you'd like.
So am I upper class now?
Absolutely. You're a dead ringer for Lord Snooty.
Thank you, Jacob Rees-Mogg. You have shown that class is interesting, and we should know about it, but not get stuck in it if we's going to get ahead. Wicked.
Thank you.
So I think actually survived that fairly well, Rees-Mogg. But we do, Martin, we do like to poke fun at people who are from the upper class for this reason. I suppose that is because there are a tremendous amount of people now, much more than in the past, suffering as the whole welfare system is just kind of collapsed underneath them.
Well, yes, and of course Rees-Mogg is definitely looking to be the leader of the Tory party and Prime Minister without an election. Whether the Tories would be wise to choose somebody like him to lead them, who's obviously got his finger on the pulse of modern Britain, I can imagine that some of their spin doctors wouldn't be very happy to have to try and sell him in Hartcliffe.
Stephen, it's not often I quote The Sun, but Rich Mogg, they call him. Tory rising star Jacob Rees-Mogg's one of Parliament's richest MPs, raking in £1 million a year, roughly, at least.
A billion, don't you?
And the unlikely social media star owns a stake in capital management firm that paid out £21 million to its members. I mean, they've just done some of the sums, because even though he's obliged to tell everybody what he gets in terms of salary, it return on his investments, that's all hidden.
Yeah, I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg as Prime Minister could be the day that I leave the country. I'm not sure I could really cope with that. Theresa May was pretty grim, but Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Well, I mean, his father was the editor of the Times, actually quite an eloquent guy.
He was, yeah. I think he made the money, didn't he, for the family, pretty much.
I think they made it through mining from years ago.
They're coal owners.
Are they? Okay.
Educated at Eton and Trinity College. He also worked for the prestigious Rothschild Investment Bank before joining Lord George Management. So, a bit, actually, Martin, it's a bit like Macron. He also worked for the Rothschilds. Now he's Prime Minister or President of France.
Yeah. And Jacob Rees-Mogg is very ambitious. His father was very ambitious for him. And he always wanted to be Prime Minister. And in fact, he was promised that he would be made a minister if in the Tory government, but because of the coalition with the Liberals, they put the kibosh on that, and he wasn't allowed to be a minister.
This isn't really about policies, though, is it? This is about Brexit.
There wasn't enough seats. The Liberals had to have their quota of seats, so we had to go.
What I meant is the chance of him being leader of the Tory party, I don't think that would happen in normal circumstances, because most of the country would absolutely reject that choice. But this is about Brexit, really.
But it's the Tory party, surely, that's going to elect them.
The right wing of the Tory party are quite happy with him.
But at some stage, the Tory party are going to have to stand in a general election. Yeah. Do they really want to stand up with Jacob Rees-Mogg, leading them in the debates? Can you imagine him in a debate with Jeremy Corbyn? I pay good money to see that, actually.
Oh, yeah, I think
Jeremy Corbyn and Jacob Rees-Mogg.
We've had Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Just a minute, because we just heard from the Ali G show, he can actually stand up to criticism quite well. And, I think it's very easy to say, oh, this person's no good. But, surely he's stood up there, and he's done quite a good job since in... he's a Brexiteer, which you don't agree with, either of you two probably wouldn't agree with, but he's actually stood up to criticism fairly well, surely.
But he represents not just the 1%, but the 0.0001%. And people in the country recognise that. And the time when this country wants a leader like that, aristocratic person like that, is gone.
But doesn't Theresa May, her husband is the boss of this capital management firm, a big American firm?
I'm not going to defend Theresa May, but it's less extreme with Theresa May.
Is it his accent you don't like? I sound like Ali G now.
It's his policies I don't like. I'm not bothered about his accent. I mean, Tony Benn was from the aristocracy, and I love Tony Benn. It's not about his education, even. It's about his policies.
Okay. Also, looking at some of the more national stories, self-driving lorries are to be tested on UK roads. Is this a good idea? Self-driving lorries?
I don't know. I know that in the States, a lot of the poorer people there are very worried about their jobs because they see them being taken away by this kind of device. So it's going to be a problem for jobs unless those jobs are replaced in some way. I don't actually know whether it's a good idea or not, really. It seems a bizarre thing, the idea of a lorry trundling down the M4 without somebody keeping an eye on it.
Well, they're saying apparently that there's going to be like one guide lorry at the front and a whole load of lorries kind of following it.
Well, so it's like a train. I mean, the Greens are in favour of trains, so,
Well, I think you've put your finger on the fundamental problem. I mean, look, Bill Gates was saying that everything is going to be robotised. Everything. And... those who believe in the free market believe that new jobs will be created. But of course, what will probably happen, especially under the dispensation we've got now, where the wealthy have so much power, is that new jobs won't be created because the purchasing power of the poor and the lower classes simply won't be protected.
Aren't we moving?
And therefore,
into
there will be a crash.
Well, we're moving
and then,
into a
and
world.
Then you and then of course you'd have to reorganise society on a different.
Aren't
basis.
We moving into a world where workers just become superfluous?
Not completely superfluous, because they need people to buy the stuff they're producing, and that's what used to happen from 1945 to 1973 in the developed world. Basically, wages rose year on year as productivity rose, and those wages were paid. Workers were strong enough to gain those wage increases, which were real wage increases. And what's happened since 1979 is that although productivity has continued to increase by leaps and bounds, wages have not followed. And of course, then people have to borrow, and then when they borrow, that's okay, it can keep running for a while, but then of course eventually it has to be paid back and then it all crashes.
I mean, we're all of the same kind of era, if you like, and you can probably remember, or I can remember when I was young, that people were saying, well, when the robots are running all the factories, you'll all only have to work 2 or 3 days a week, there'll be loads of holidays, leisure time. What happened to that? Actually, people are working longer hours, they've got zero contracts, and they're in a much worse situation. So where's the money gone? Answer to people like Jacob Rees-Mogg and his like.
This quantitative easing is a bit fictitious, isn't it? Because it doesn't actually seem to make its way to ordinary people. It just sort of seems to stay, Martin, and people who are big investors, like...
It's just a decision to prop up the existing financial structure rather than, if you were going to, you know, provide money to people, you could have provided it at the bottom, for example, by cancelling their debts and council tax debts or whatever, and then that would have protected the economy in a similar way. But they made the decision to bail the financial system out as it was then constituted, and of course they haven't reformed it. People don't realise that we're still on zero interest rates. We had a big dollop of quantitative easing after the Brexit vote, and it's all completely artificial. The right wing economists are right about this. It's totally artificial and it will crash.
Well, talking of money, pound is worth less than a euro in British airports. It's the first time, as it's plummeted to an 8-year low, and this is Russia Today actually reporting this. The official exchange rate of British pound has fallen to 1.085, the lowest rate since 2009, but at British airports, £1 sterling buys less than €1. So we're getting quite close to parity. This is also, everyone's keeping an eye on the euro's parity, potentially with the Swiss franc as well, which is, so it looks like possibly the pound might sink below the euro, the euro becoming, I suppose, €1 becoming the most valuable currency in the world.
Yeah, well, in theory, it's good for exporters, of course, but it's probably bad for you and me who are buying Japanese televisions or going on holiday to Spain. It's actually surprising that more people haven't made a fuss about this. You know, people going on holiday, for example, there hasn't really been a lot of talk about
it. But you can't do much, can you? Martin, what does it mean, parity? Is it important?
Well, it is important. I mean, what's supposed to happen, as Stephen says, it's supposed to help exporters, but you've got to have an export industry to export, and we haven't. This is the problem. We've deindustrialised over the period of this neoliberal hegemony, and therefore when the price signal changes, that ought to be a chance for British manufacturers. But in fact, people don't want to buy it. We don't manufacture anything, and services are not really very price sensitive. So if you could say it's like a J-curve effect, you know, when the pound goes down, there's going to be a balance of payments is going to get worse and then get better, but there's no evidence that it's getting better. And I think the other thing you've got to say about this is that ultimately they may have to raise interest rates to protect the pound. There may be a run on the pound, and if there'd been a Labour government, for example, and the pound had fallen by 20%, you can imagine what the Tory press would have made of that. They'd be going, this is evidence of complete incompetence. But of course ultimately they may have to raise interest rates to protect the pound. At that point the housing market will collapse, and then we'll have the general election. This will be before Christmas, Tony.
The Unleash Hell, this is in the Daily Mirror, it's Unleash Hell. Britain battles the EU's plans to wreck the UK car industry by stopping manufacturers selling service deals. If service deals are stopped, it'll affect UK car makers who sell 700,000, I mean, talking about an export industry, Martin, 700,000 cars a year. In instalment deals, usually include servicing for the lease period. So this is one of those things that they're having to talk about with the EU about. And whilst the Brits are saying, well, look, you know, you can sell your service deals if you sell cars over here to the Europeans. The Europeans are saying, well, we're not going to let you sell them here. So, I mean,
this is the Express, isn't it?
No, the Mirror.
All right.
I mean, this is... It does seem as if Brussels are playing hardball.
Well, I'm not sure we're really hearing any of the truth that's coming out of the negotiations. I mean, the fact is that these negotiations are so complex, and they're effectively now going to have to be done in less than a year. It feels to me almost impossible that they can be done in any sensible way, and in the last couple of months there'll be some terrible decisions made. I mean, cars is a good example, of course, because you say we export cars. Well, actually, we import lots of components and then we put them together in Airfix kits and then we export them. So, we're in a globalised industrial state, and it's not always that clear who's exporting and who's importing.
This seems to be a pretty clear case of the EU, it seems, just simply wanting to punish Britain for Brexit. Now, there are a lot of other countries, not least of which is Greece, looking at the EU, or do we want to stay in this club? Don't you think Britain's being punished?
I'm not sure, really, Tony. I don't know the detail of the story, actually. I think it would be good for Europe. It would be good for the EC if you accept that we're going to leave. I think it's good for both parties that we leave on good terms, because clearly we're a big trading partner with the EC. So it's not in their interest that we go down the pan. On the other hand, they don't want to give us a really good deal, because then, as you say, people like Greece and Holland might say, well, we might as well leave as well.
Martin, people are looking at this, commentators around the world, at this growing gap, really, between what Britain wants and what the people in Brussels are prepared to give, and very little is actually being negotiated. It seems to be coming clearer and clearer that it may be no deal at all. And Jacob Rothschild this week has reported in Zero Hedge and various other places, saying that share prices are at unprecedented levels. This is not a time to add risk. So he's, I suppose, in City of London speak, saying things are getting pretty shaky.
Yeah, it was what I said earlier. What will happen when it becomes clear that Brexit is it's just a mess. Yeah, and we're leaving aside that it's a good or bad idea in principle, the actual negotiations, we're going to end up crashing out on WTO rules, what terms or whatever, and that means there's a whole lot more for the pound to go down. They've already, the pound crashed after Brexit because the market were pricing in what they thought the consequences would be. But if it turns out that Brexit is really going to be a mess, then they'll have to price it in further. So there'll be a run on the pound. At that point, Philip Hammond has to raise interest rates. At that point, house prices collapse and Britain has a Brexit recession. And if Britain has a Brexit recession, I think the people who wanted Brexit are going to find that the majority aren't with them. And there's going to be big changes.
There's certainly changes going on with regard to migrants and how they're being treated here in Britain, particularly EU migrants. I noticed a story by Richard Vaughan last Sunday in the iNews paper. Home Office is using homeless charity databases to deport EU nationals. Home Office officials are using a homeless person's database to weed out EU... I hate the word weed out, excuse me. These are human beings we're talking about. EU nationals in a bid to remove them from the UK as part of collective expulsions, according to campaigners. The Whitehall Department was given secret access to a mapping tool used by a Greater London Authority to enable them to monitor and locate rough sleepers on the basis of their nationality. Details emerged through a series of freedom of information requests by the civil rights charity Liberty Stone.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just one example where big data is being collected and will ultimately be used against us if the right regulations aren't in place to protect us. I mean, the idea of information being collected for homeless charity purposes and being used for something completely different is just horrible. I find that quite scary.
This is quite sinister, Martin, isn't it? So you're in a shop doorway, someone says, I'm here to help you. Yeah. You just tell me maybe I can help you. Actually, what they're doing is they're basically undercover working for the Home Office, and all they're really interested in doing is getting them out of the country.
Well, in which case people won't cooperate with people asking them legitimate questions. The other thing that's come out this week is that of students that come here to study, virtually all of them, apart from 3%, go back to their home countries after they've studied. So Theresa May's come under pressure to say, well, you know, we've got to exclude students that come here to our world-class universities like Bristol University. They shouldn't be included in the migrant statistics because, you know, 97% of them go back to where they came from. And the other 3% you'd probably be glad to have because they're skilled people that probably can pay taxes and improve your economy.
I can just say, Tony, that people may not know this, how terrified European nationals living in Bristol are about Brexit. I mean, as a local councillor, I've had many, many conversations with Germans and Italians and literally in tears and saying, well, what's going to happen to us? Will we have to leave? I met a woman who was scared to go home to her mother's funeral in Germany because she was worried she wouldn't get back in.
I don't think there's any real threat of that, is there? Certainly until Brexit itself.
I'm just talking about the perception.
Maybe this is the mainstream press spreading fear.
Well, maybe it is. But I'm just talking about the perception.
Yeah.
And how people who've... You know, people who are German... I mean, there's somebody who lives in my street who's German, married to an English guy, got two kids who were born in the UK. She hasn't got a UK passport, and she's really worried.
But there are also, of course, Brits in Spain who must be thinking, well, have we got the right to stay here? We're not really sure.
They didn't get to vote in the referendum, the Brits in Spain, of course.
Critically ill 2-year-old, this is the Mirror again, they seem to be doing some brilliant stuff on homelessness and other similar related stuff at the moment on in the Mirror. Critically ill 2-year-old was left homeless after repossessing agents were forced, in inverted commas, to evict a family. Agents Vince and Stuart faced their most difficult situation ever on a program called Can't Pay, Well Take It Away. Well, this is this kind of welfare porn or something that they put on television. But there's a serious side to this, because we're in a situation where the family were left devastated when they revealed to the agents the landlord had waited just 48 hours they'd been able to move to a house provided by the council. Instead, this critically ill 2-year-old Martin has been left homeless.
Well, housing is becoming an increasingly fundamental problem for lots of people in the society, particularly in this city. And, of course, if people are being pushed from pillar to post, they're very unlikely to be registered to vote. Even if they were registered to vote, because of the first-past-the-post system, it just piles up votes in inner-city areas which don't change the overall result. And, therefore, policy is made by those who have got the foot on the housing ladder, and people who manipulate those with the foot on the housing ladder, which of course is conscious policy. It's been pursued for years by the Tory party, and it's to create a property owning democracy, otherwise known as an oligarchy, and that's where we're at.
It's pretty horrific, isn't it? Evicting critically ill 2-year-old. You know, what the hell is going on in this country?
I mean, it's completely ridiculous, isn't it? It makes you ashamed to be British, actually. I mean, Martin was talking about the government and housing. I mean, the planning system, which I'm involved in Bristol to a certain extent. I'm on one of the planning committees. Is so stacked against affordable houses, for example. I mean, I was involved in the chocolate factory debate, and if you play by the rules, if you play by the government rules, it's just ridiculous. It's almost impossible to get affordable houses. And if you go against the government rules, then the developer appeals, which is what happened in the chocolate factory, and you end up with an even worse deal. It's people blame the council and blame the planners and blame the councillors who sit on those committees. It's the government policies that's the problem.
It seems to me like these little sort of toll booths that you've got to put your money into are going up everywhere. Things that used to be provided by the government, public services, suddenly they're not available anymore, and you've got to get your credit card out or your swipe card or whatever and pay for these things. But surely that's what the government's there for, to provide these.
Yeah, I mean, the current round of cuts, coming back to those, you know, one of them is public toilets are going to be much reduced. Actually, they should be increased, particularly those with proper access for disabled people. I mean, most of the public toilets are going to be closed. 2/3 of the libraries potentially are going to be closed. You know, and yet, as Martin said, perhaps you said, we're the fifth richest country in the world. This is crazy.
Talking of which, on evictions, another story this week. British, and this was really good to see someone actually putting these figures together. First time I've seen them. British property divide was revealed as over 5 million people own second homes, despite 250,000 people across the country, that's a quarter of a million families, being homeless. Second home ownership has rocketed by 30% in about a decade, with 1 in 10 adults now having another property in addition to their main home. So we're talking about this at the beginning, really, with this wealth divide. It's the property divide too.
Yeah, it's very, very hard for young people. When I was young, it was much, much easier to buy houses, much easier to get a job. Things were much easier.
Doesn't some of this come back to immigration? Because we've had something like 200,000, 300,000 people coming in. Obviously, there's a massive, massive immigrants, demand on housing.
Immigrants bring wealth to this country.
But they need housing, and we haven't been building enough houses.
We haven't been building enough houses, and that's partly because of the system. The developers have been buying land, getting planning permission, and just not building the houses. I mean, the council, to be fair, Paul Smith, who's the cabinet member for housing, has been doing a good job in trying to get those schemes built. And, you know, Marvin has obviously made a strong commitment. So I'm hopeful that we are going to move forward a bit. I think we talked about George earlier, and I think that was a bit of a blind spot for George, actually, housing.
I'm sure Paul will be very pleased to hear he's a minister, but I mean, is he actually
member of the cabinet?
I know, I mean, it does seem that they're really going all out to build a few hundred council houses, but it's not going to be enough, is it?
Oh, well, it's certainly not going to be enough. I mean, the demand seems insatiable, and there's a lot of pent-up demand from the last 10 years of effectively of Tory rule. So it's not going to be enough. But I applaud what Labour are doing around housing, and as I said, I think Paul Smith's doing a good job.
Martin, 5 million have second homes, and yet we've got 250,000 families homeless.
Well, it's this model of not providing social housing started in 1979. We had 13 years of Labour government where they didn't actually do anything about it. And now, of course, you've finally reached the end of the point. And when we say there's pent-up demand, there's demand in the sense that people need housing, but these people haven't got the wherewithal to pay for housing. In the 1950s, the Tory government built the biggest council housing programme in British history, and everybody knew at that stage what the point of that was. There should be a clear choice, decent, affordable council housing, or getting on the housing ladder for those who wanted to. And it made it easier for the people to get on the housing ladder because the prices were lower. And everybody knew this. We all knew this. And in 1979, we threw the baby out of the window, and unfortunately, it's been splattered on the pavement ever since.
May I put the same question to you as I put to Stephen just now? Surely this has got something to do with immigration. When you've got 300,000 more people coming into Britain every year, it's going to make a massive increase in demand for housing.
Shall I tell you something that happened a few years ago? There's a chap who owns... He's the biggest buy-to-let owner in the southeast of England, and he's a big Tory party donor. I've forgotten his name. And when Universal Credit was discussed by Ian Duncan Smith, and he said, I'm not going to pay the landlords directly, but I'm going to pay my money to the beneficiaries, and then they will have to learn to manage their money and pay their landlords themselves. He said, well, that's quite straightforward. He said, I've got hundreds of people who are currently on benefits in my houses. I'm not only going to take no more people on benefits, this will be British people, I want all of those people out, and I want Eastern Europeans who are in work and are going to pay the rent. And in actual fact, the real problem is fundamental. Let's just say if the population had increased not through immigration, just through natural growth. That's one of the reasons why we've got the fifth biggest economy in the world, Tony, is because the immigration in this country has actually boosted the GNP, because the young people that come in with skills and pay taxes and don't actually take money out because they tend not to use the health service.
Surely most of the jobs are the lower paid jobs, aren't they, where people are paying very little tax?
Well, that's not true. There's a whole spectrum of jobs here that they do, and immigrants are a net payers into the financial system.
Well, there are people of very different points of view of that, because some will say that the migrants taking lower paid jobs means that actually the welfare bill is much greater, but the welfare bill is being kept down because people are being sanctioned, kicked off the dole, etc., and many of them are sleeping rough, etc. So I want to look now at the other end of the spectrum again. You know, we're going backwards and forwards between the rich and the poor, the rich and the poor, to look at the top of the feudal system, because I think we've got a kind of banking oligarchy feudal system, but there is also the old feudal system, the royal family, in the background. And there was this documentary on a few weeks ago called Diana in Her Own Words, which had, I thought, some fascinating insights into the way the royal family really operates. And on that documentary was the first interview I've seen, proper one anyway, with Princess Diana's bodyguard, Ken Wharfe, who was talking about a note that Diana left saying, "My husband is planning a car accident." That's an actual quote. And she goes on in paraphrasing it to say, so that he can marry someone else.
Diana sadly dies in a tragic road accident in Paris. And then what happens? The Prince of Wales did marry Camilla Parker Bowles. If only Diana could have been around, she would have said to me, "You see, Ken, I wasn't wrong, was I?"
A lot of the things that I admired about the monarchy, for me, died with the Princess of Wales. And more than that, with the way in which she was treated before she died. That idea of the monarchy has died for me.
The idea that respect should be given unthinkingly or out of blind loyalty has gone.
Well, that was Princess Diana's former bodyguard, Ken Wolfe, followed by her private secretary and former naval officer, Patrick Jeffson, as part of that documentary, Diana in Her Own Words. You might still be able to catch that on the Channel 4 site. I'll put a link up to it on our show page if you can. But I suppose the main point here is... maybe we'll talk you first of all, Stephen, is that there seems to be this sort of, I mean, particularly with this private secretary, it's the first interview I've seen with him, he's effectively saying, look, you know, as an ex-military man, I've got no respect left for the royal family anymore, as I've seen how it operates.
Yeah, just one interesting thing from a personal point of view. I was in Paris, actually, when Lady Di was killed, and I drove through the underpass the day before she died, and I was leaving Paris. We went into a petrol station, and this woman who sold us the petrol said, "Lady Di, mort, mort." And I thought, well, yeah, I'm not particularly a Republican myself, but that's a bit extreme. She said, no, Lady Di, mort, mort. And she died just literally half a mile away from where this petrol station was. In terms of, I mean, conspiracy theories are so easy to spread, particularly in these days of social media. I've got no idea, and I don't think we'll ever know what really happened. I saw part of that documentary, and it's pretty clear that Lady Di was sort of left out to hang by the royals. You know, she was in an impossible situation right from the start. Really, as she said herself, there was three of us in this marriage.
And Prince Charles still trying to deny that he was having a relationship with Camilla in an interview with Richard Dimbleby, Jonathan Dimbleby, I think, as well. So, really? You know, the whole thing is pretty worrying, really. Do you think there's any future for the royals?
I wouldn't be surprised if Charles never became king, if they skipped a generation. I think that would be a good move from a sort of PR point of view. And rather like the Conservative Party, I think the monarchy are an organisation that know how to survive. So I wouldn't be totally surprised to see that happen, actually.
Also, Martin, we talked about Jacob Rothschild earlier on, but Prince Charles and Camilla were over in Corfu, weren't they? Staying that weekend, that documentary went out with Jacob Rothschild.
Well, that may be so, and these elites tend to mix together, and they tend to hang together, don't they? So, no surprises there.
Future for the royal family.
Well, yes, because they're there, and unless the constitution's changed, they're going to remain there.
It's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest. That was Southfield Councillor Stephen Clark.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.